Welcome to the Cosmic Citizen, ladies and gentlemen. This is Andre Traversa. With me is Paula Thompson. And we are going to talk today, as Paula said, about little ones, which means children. We're going to talk about family. We were doing that a couple of weeks ago. It's kind of interesting how that all sort of came about. We were doing an open phone segment. We just happened to start talking about family issues, parenting issues, fathering, mothering. So I figured, well, why not continue this thread? I wanted to continue it last week, but was not able to. So we ended up having Brother Dave on the show last week, which was great. But today we have a couple of people with us who are longtime Urantz Book readers, as well as people who are very committed to issues of children, child-rearing, family. And they are both psychotherapists in Pueblo, Colorado. We have with us Buck and Arlene Weimer. Welcome to the Cosmic Citizen, you guys.
Thanks.
Well, thank you, Andre, and hello, Paula.
Hi, guys.
You're welcome.
You know, Andre, I have to point something out. Last week we had Brother Dave, who was the person that turned you on to the book, and this week we have Buck and Arlene, who are the people that turned me on to the book. So,
how appropriate.
How appropriate.
Yes.
Well, that's great. That's great. It's kind of one of those interesting coincidences there that we have going on. I want to start out for a couple of things. There's so many things we could discuss, but one of the things, Buck and Arlene, that you guys both do at conferences a lot is you talk a lot about why children need fathers as well as mothers and vice versa. In the Urantia book, in paper 47, I believe it is, in the Mansion World papers, they talk about how children need fathers as well as mothers, that it's great that mothers spend so much time with their kids, but that children need both. Before we talk about why children need fathers and mothers, I think we need to talk about something even more fundamental, because it's something that both of you guys discuss at conferences. I've heard you guys speak about it. And that is the fact that men and women are different. They're not the same. That the differences complement each other. And, you know, we live in an age of political correctness where, especially on a lot of university campuses, where you're not supposed to talk about the differences between men and women. Feminists will have a field day. You know, they just have fits about that. They say, there are no such thing. Gender is just a socially constructed myth. There's no such thing as gender. I've heard it all before. Let's talk a little bit about that. What are some of the differences? Let's just talk, first of all, are there differences between men and women, aside from physical ones? And what are some of those differences?
Buck, you want to give that one to me?
Either one of you guys.
Go ahead, start.
Start with that. Well, we can just start, you know, one thing we are, as human beings, we're more alike than not alike. So I just want to preface the differences by saying we're human beings and we have a whole lot more in common than we have not in common. But yes, there are differences, and I'll start with those that are found in the brain. The corpus callosum, which is the part of the brain, it's like a band of nerves that connects the right side of the brain to the left side of the brain, is 50% larger in females than males. Now, you can go off and say this is why some of the reasons we have these differences. I will project and say these are some of the differences that come out of that. One, we can connect, we can get the information from the logical left side of the brain to the creative emotional side of the brain and vice versa more easily. So in some ways, that means we can express and understand and make sense of our feelings more easily. And I think that's a common thread in relationships where, you know, the male will say, I just don't get it. She's so emotional. You know, she just gets all these feelings. And the other is it also probably makes us more intuitive because we can look at things more holistically. And so we connect, you know, the bigger picture. Other studies show that when men and women are stimulated, the brain responds differently. In women, there's more parts of the brain that are responding electrochemically, and in men, it's usually a one part of the brain that's responding. So that, again, translated to me means men focus on one issue, and they're really good.
I was just going to say, does that mean that women are better at multitasking?
And that was what my
Absolutely.
Next sentence was. We are better at multitasking, and if you want to get, you know, down to it, you know, think about the cavemen and women. Women were home and having to make sure that, you know, the laundry was clean, the garden was made, the floor didn't have any major objects that the kids could choke on, and the man was out on the hunt, one focus, and he was the protector, come back, protect, and be on the hunt. And developmentally, we find that until middle age, there is that difference. Men focus more on making their mark, doing their thing, getting out there and having a career. And I'm not saying that women don't do this, because many women do. But women, we have this biological clock that really hits in the 30s, it did for me, where you have this need to, you know, rock the cradle and make the nest and multitask. And relationships are a key for women.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. It's almost a stereotype to say that, you know, that women are more concerned about relationships and men are more concerned about achievement. But the thing is, those stereotypes exist because there's some truth in them.
Well, and you know, I think that is the survival of the race. We have to be very responsive to that baby's needs, you know, from, the, you know, when it's in vitro on, in order for the child to survive. However, it's very interesting in menopause, and men do go through menopause as well, there is a role reversal. And men become more focused on and more aware and more responsive and more needful of relationships. And women get more of the balance of testosterone, a little bit, you know, in terms of balance of hormones. They have a little bit less of the estrogen. And women become more focused out, you know, on maybe making their mark and living their passion or not caretaking as much. So those are some of the differences that I see. I don't know, Buck, if you have anything to add.
Well, I think basically males take an outward view of themselves, reality in the universe, and females basically take an inward view of themselves and of reality and of the universe. And so I'm always liking to tell the story of Andon and Fanta and how they cooperated to discover fire. And it was like Andon knew that there was a spark coming from that flintstone, and he knew that somehow or another you could start a fire with that, but it just wasn't working for him. And, of course, it took Fanta to recognize that if you get an old dried-out bird's nest and put under that, that would spark the fire, and that's exactly what happened. So the two of them together actually were the starters of fire, and that forever marked the differentiation between animals and humans, because only humans can control fire.
Paul, I want to make sure that you get a chance to jump in here.
I have a question. Do you think that, and I know they've done a lot of studies on, and I think I mentioned that when we did our last show, it just came out that the studies that they've done on the differences between male and female from birth on and how they've identified, there's just basic reactionary differences. They can put them in the same situation, and they consistently react in the same way but different. A girl will act differently than a boy in the same situation, and it's consistent. Boys typically act that way. Girls typically act that way. And so do you think that, from Andon and Fanta, which, as we know as Urantia book readers, are the first two humans, male and female, the first human pair, that these differences are in some ways or in most ways hardwired, or do they evolve over time? Like when I was at the Parliament in Spain, they talked about there's a women's movement called Peace by Peace, and it's about circles, and it's about women gathering in circles as they have done for millions of years, and how we naturally want to gather because we're circles, but also because we were at home holding down the hearth and the hearth fires and whatever while the men were out hunting, we naturally got more social. So I wonder how much of it is nature and how much of it is just, you know, evolutionary, that that's the roles as they played out.
Well, I think that's always the question, that nature nurture, and and most all of the findings that I have come across, it's you've got to give both credit. It's not one or the other. The studies that you speak about are very interesting. one that comes to mind is the toddlers, 3 years old, put in a kind of a pen situation where there was no way to get out. And the little boys kept trying. They continued to look for a way to get out. The little girls gave up in about, you know, just about 5 minutes or less and started calling for mommy. So, and right. And there was another kind of a unreal experiment that was done with twins that I've in Canada not too long ago. It was unfortunate, but they actually tried to do a sex change with one of the twins to see if there was a nature-nurture thing. And this poor man, you know, when he finally became aware that he was really a man and not a girl, I mean, throughout his life, he knew he was something wrong with him. And you know, eventually it was a very sad scene because he ended his life. But there wasn't, you know, the family made him believe he was a girl, you know, the doctors. And for some reason they did this because of an anatomical difference when they were born. But it turned out to be a really disaster.
Mm. You know, one of the things that we spoke about on the air, or we read from this passage a couple of times. Right? I think we read from it once last week and the week before. There's a passage in the Jesus Papers in the Arantia book called A Day Alone with God in the Hills, where Jesus is talking to John Mark, the young teenager who was kind of lingering about around hanging out with the apostles and Jesus. And one of the things it says in that passage is one of my favorite passages in the book. And I'll kind of give you guys my idea of what I think it means and see if you can add anything or agree or disagree. Jesus says to John Mark, he says that a child gets his first concept of the universe from his mother and his first concept of God from his father. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, again, this is another one. A lot of feminists would just have a fit if they read this. They'd be like, are you saying that you know, men represent God more than women do and blah, blah. And when I finally read that, I started thinking, well, of course that's true. And the reason it's true is, what is a child's first universe? A child's first universe is the womb, okay? And so when they come out of the womb, you know, the father has to come in from the outside. He kind of invades the child's space in a positive sense. That's kind of my take on that passage. What do you guys think that means?
Buck, you want to go there?
Well, you know, I would say that there are several hints throughout the Urantia book that indicate that the early concepts of deity in general come from the father. And I think there may have been some social studies done on that to indicate that, and that so psychologically speaking, how you function socially may to a large degree be determined by the type of relationship you have had with your mother. And your early, at least your early concepts or precepts about God, again, to a large degree, are determined by the kind of relationship you have with your father. In other words, for instance, if you had no relationship or an antagonistic relationship with your father, there could be some indication that would be how you, at least initially, view God or the deities. And the same is true socially. You know, depending on that kind of relationship you have with your mother, to a large degree, if it was an antagonistic relationship, there's a very good, some good indicators that you know, you may function or dysfunction antisocially. So there's a fair amount of information indicating those two, that, you know, one is determined by the father, God, and the other socially is determined by the mother.
Can I just add something here? I know in my practice, my private practice as a clinical psychologist for 30 years, I kind of tested that theory out and found it pretty reasonable. Now, of course, you're, you know, the observer effect, and you see what you want to see, but I find that is can be a reality and relationship with the father and how disconnected or connected you have felt with the father, your biological father or step parent, whatever, will affect, you know, the connection or closeness you have with your father God. And, you know, we know that that doesn't mean women are less spiritual, because we also read in the book about how, you know, the hand that rocks the cradle fraternizes with destiny, and that women are spiritual leaders because we have that kind of unconditional, all-accepting, all-forgiving love. You know, if you ask a mother, you know, what if your kid committed murder, you know, what would you do? Well, I'd still love him. I'd forgive him. Well, there'd be consequences, but I'd love them, and I'd never.
You know what? I love the Urantia book's insight about the fact that we live in a dual origin universe, which is mother and father, or space and time.
Right.
Mother is space, father
right.
is time.
Right.
And I have gained a lot of insight just from pondering that, because, you know, we are in the space, which is the mother of the universe, is the space of the universe. Nebadon is the mother, and Michael is the father. He's time. We know from the book gives us some great teachings about how Nebadon is everywhere present. The mother spirit, I call her Nebadon because
right.
that's who she is. She's everywhere present at the same time, whereas Michael can transcend space and can be anywhere, but, you know, only once at a time. And so, you know, they complement, totally complement each other. And it occurs to me that then those patterns kind of pass all the way down. And it goes back to the question I asked you guys. I think that there is a basic pattern there that women hold space. Women become very space-oriented. And men are very transcendental, or they learn to transcend. They're very time-oriented or linear. And so, you know, women will build a home, and they just, you know, they pervade that space. That becomes their space. And they become like ministers. You know, the Urantia book calls the
right.
feminine aspect of God the divine minister.
Right.
Women are naturally ministers. Very few women I know can sit by and watch someone else suffer without going and offering some kind of help and counsel and really caring. I mean, women can never cry without somebody, you know, we all start crying. We're very tender-hearted, and men are very strong. And as I pointed out on the show we did before, Chris Halverson told me that a good father figure will help his daughter be transcendent and learn how to put something behind her. Not, you know, when something traumatic happens to a woman, it tends to get stuck in her space, and it's hard for her to transcend that. And I've noticed that people that grow up without mothers have a hard time with boundaries. They don't seem to know what's appropriate to say in a group, for instance. I've noticed this about several people that I've known that grew up without a mother. They don't seem to, you know, they just become a confession that, you know, you say whatever's on your mind. You don't, you know, you don't hold back. And they end up being very inappropriate. And that certainly goes to what you guys were saying about
socially. That's really interesting you're saying that, Paula, because you keep hearing so much about fatherlessness. I have not, actually don't think I've known anybody who grew up without a mother, so it's kind of interesting to hear you say that. It's funny because I was raised primarily by women, but I have, unfortunately, one of my problems is foot and mouth disease. I do tend to to say things without thinking, which is probably why I like talk radio, right? But anyway, I wanted to ask you guys both, what do children get? But why don't we have each one of you answer this? What do children get from mothers that they don't get from fathers, and what do children get from fathers that they don't get from? Why do children need both?
Buck, you want to start?
Well, I think first of all, it's helpful to keep in mind that we are all personality, and that personality comes from the father, but it's in dual phase, just like electricity is in dual phase. So it's a dual phase of personality, and so, you know, to be exposed to or to experience both of those phases of personality, I think is important for everybody, for anybody. What's critical, I think, number one, is that the individual, whether it be male or female, as they're entering into marriage, that they have their own strength and their own sense of identity. And that essentially comes about through decision-making process. And so the same with you know, with both genders. And so because we're so different, the Uranch book calls it antagonistic cooperation. So I think, you know, showing children that two unlike beings, like a male and a female, that can cooperate and do what they have to do. The Uranch book says something that a male and female working together can do much more than can two males working together or two females working together. So I think, you know, showing children that antagonistic cooperation, that you can function despite the difference, that you can forgive, you know, that you can solve problems, that you can work out your differences and still continue to love, I think is crucial. You know, showing that to a child or to your children is absolutely necessary.
Yeah, and I think once again, in some way, repeating what we, you know, what I've said before, females show emotions and can verbalize emotions because of the brain difference, I think, and because of nature, nurture, and all the necessity. We have that, you know, more of an emotional connection, and women have a harder time disconnecting and an easier time connecting with others. Mm-hmm. And that studies, you know, have shown that. Men have a harder time connecting and an easier time disconnecting. And that balance is real necessary. You know, when, again, like your example of that young daughter who, you know, got stuck in her emotions, well, you need at times to let go and let God and disconnect and process your losses, your griefs, your disappointments, and then you let go and you let God and let, you know, that person go on their path, because you're not in control of that other person's life. Everybody, you know, God gives us choice. God doesn't force anything on us. And so as a parent, you know, mothers can be at times more connected to their children emotionally and want to, you know, and feel their pain and want to be involved in helping them change, not that fathers don't, but it's harder for them to disconnect when the child is an adult, I believe, and then it is for the father.
Well, so, sure, and I think one reason for that, frankly, is because, you know, the child grew up in the mother's body.
Right,
you know,
absolutely.
I mean, that's a bond that I as a man will never understand.
Right, right. And the other thing that Paula said, you know, very, you know, astutely, that women have the space connection. Like, I think women can feel how their children are doing, whether they're, you know, hundreds, thousands of miles away. That, you know, we have that connection. That intuition comes through. Oh, yeah, I don't know if my kid, I better call him. Whereas a male can be back on his trail of focus. I'm doing something, and I can disconnect from what happens to my child right at this moment. I can be on my, you know, linear line of idea. And that's another pattern that the universe, Mother Spirit, and Michael, son, has different. And that's, you know, the Michael, son, has the idea, the pattern, the sperm. And the female, the mother spirit, manifests it, makes it happen, gets pregnant,
right.
and the baby grows within. So she manifests the idea. And I know in my relationship with Buck, that's very true. I mean, Buck is an idea man, and thinks about, you know, eternity and things that will work here. And then I can take that idea that we agree on, and as a multitasker, manifest it.
Work out the details.
Work out the details, which, you know, is a difference, exactly. You know, work out the details, and you could either drive each other crazy because, hey, you're not working out the details and you're not, you know, understanding my ideas, or you could see the complementary aspect of that and say, yeah, okay, got the idea, now it's, here you go, you help me, you know, we'll help each other with the idea, and then we'll help each other manifest the detail. But the female has that, you know, ministry manifestation of detail.
You know, that's one thing that just being around you guys, I admire and respect about you so much, is you're such a strong couple. You've been together for, what, 35 years or more?
More.
And,
40 more.
Or I want to date you guys.
Okay.
I know you've been together a long, long time. You've been married a long, long time. You seem to have such a deep mutual respect for one another.
I think that's
and,
really
it's
key.
Really it just you really are a great partnership. I mean, you just kind of you're like a great tag team. You pass off to each other. You defer to each other. You know each other's strengths and weaknesses. You're awesome to be around. You're inspiring in that respect to see, you know, how great a marriage can be and how effective it can be. And you know, you've raised three wonderful boys, and they're just all such fine young men. And, you know, so I really admire and respect that in both of you, and I always have. And it's interesting. People always ask you to speak about this very thing because you exemplify it. And so that's really an honor to you. But and then you have this other side of that where you professionally helped people for many years, and I'm wondering what you think in your considerable experience is something that young people could do that would really help them not fall into this trap of you know, I don't know how to put it, getting married before they're ready, marrying the wrong person.
Absolutely,
you know,
good question,
this is,
Paula.
This is what we wanted to talk
direction about.
Yeah. First, can I just, you know, say that, you know, I thank you for giving us all the accolades, and you know, that's true in a large, you know, part about our relationship, but we work on that, and that's what we want to talk about.
Yeah.
How, you know, couples can prepare, and all through their relationship, how to work out those differences so that instead of, you know, going into misery, you have the work of love, which takes a whole lot of energy and time and thought and respect, absolutely respect. Knowing our differences and knowing that, you know, we can come to a place of our way, not my way or your way, that's such a key. So we were hoping to talk some about that because that's a crucial aspect. I mean, the most important thing we do in this life, I believe, is raise a family. Or be, you know, we have the career and we add to the world, but the, you know, the building blocks of civilization are, you know, start in the family. And if we raise children who are peace-loving, and because they see how you negotiate differences, you know, you'll get a person who can go out in society and work with people as a team cooperatively and come to, you know, problem solve and, you know, do things together and make things happen for the betterment of civilization. So, Buck, you want to go?
I would feedback on what that same theme that Paula is suggesting there and encourage the whole concept of preparation. Now, we can say preparation for what? And well, you know, we can prepare for marriage, first of all. We can prepare for having that first child. And when we go from a relationship of two people into having that first child, we have just entered into a whole new realm. We've now become a member of a group. So making that adjustment from going from a relationship of two into a group, and again, that group can grow. It can be 3, 4, 5, 6, however how many children you have. But the idea is that you have to personally make that or those adjustments from, first of all, being an individual and then being an individual within a relationship and then being an individual within a relationship within a family. And making those adjustments is probably the greatest adjustment you'll ever make in this lifetime. And so preparing for that is absolutely critical. And again, preparing for every stage. You know, when children are infants and then they're toddlers, you know, they have very little capacity for decision making. And so then part of the role of a parent then is to slowly integrate and develop and honor their decision-making process so that gradually over time until they become early adults, they begin to make more and more of the relationships to determine their own destiny rather than you making all of them or you making none of them. So you gradually integrate that decision-making process so that by doing that, then what you do is you gradually over time, you change your relationship from parent-child to adult to adult.
Yeah, that's so difficult, Buck, because, you know,
I think it's for a lot of parents. I'm going to share some. I try to share as much of my own personal junk or dirty laundry, if you will, on the air as I deem appropriate, because I think it's important for listeners to know that they're not the only ones struggling with things. So let me in the interest of doing that, let me say that some of you, most of the listeners, I think, know that I am disabled. I am completely blind. And unfortunately, I'm in a position right now where I'm 38 years old, and unfortunately I'm in a position right now where I happen to be living with my mom, although she's not home very much. She's gone. She is in Florida most of the time. In fact, she just left today to go there for 3 weeks, thank God. But anyway, the thing is, it's difficult because one of the things that happens with me is my mom still, unfortunately, likes to treat me like I'm 10 years old or 14 years old. You know, I find it very patronizing. It's very difficult, unfortunately, I'm in a situation right now where I don't have a way of getting out at the moment. But the point is that it's a very, very difficult dynamic because one of the things that happens, you talk about I think this is particularly difficult for mothers, to let children make their own mistakes, let them make their own decisions, even as adults, especially as adults, but, to let them skin their knee a little bit, let them do that. I think one of the things that one of the things that I struggle with my own mom, and I'm just kind of wondering if you guys had any advice for mothers on this, is mothers worry. This is one of the things mothers do, and to some extent it's natural. But like I think in my own mom's case, for example, she worries and worries and obsesses right. about every little possible thing that could go wrong, with me or with anybody. What kind of advice would you give to mothers who are caught up in this thing? Because I think with a certain generation of mothers in particular, I know in my mom's generation, I think they think that worrying about their children, even when their children are adults, is their way of showing love. Right. So what would you say to mothers who are kind of caught up in this worry thing?
I'll get that one because I know that one very well originally a Jewish mother, and that's the typical Jewish mother. What's the difference between a Rottweiler and a Jewish mother? Well, the Rottweiler eventually lets go, but any mother, I don't think only Jewish, we have a hard time letting go. And I think it really is about going to the spirit, going from your human, I call myself, I have this split personality. I have this human side of worrying, because that's how I was brought up, with a Jewish mother who worried all the time and obsessed and thought that was love, to the wise spiritual woman who knows the bigger picture, that this is all in divine order, that all of these mistakes that you see your children making are there for their growth, in spirit and in adjusting to this life. And, that process of shifting from, trying to see it through God's eyes, the bigger picture, how this is all, and then looking back at your own life. I know I look back at my own life and boy, did I make mistakes. Mistakes are the things we learn from. The success is we feel security and comfort and we feel good about ourselves, but the mistakes is what really causes us to grow. The afflictions we know are where we refine the pearl. And so that wise woman, the part that is conscious of the spiritual picture, is how I help myself shift. And that shift, again, isn't easy. And part of the process for me is having friends, female friends, who understand. And I have a group once a week. I've had for 20 years now, and we just share. We're called the Codependent Therapist Group. And we share intimately all our obsessive worries. and clearing it out is an important part. If you hold it in, it's just going to get stuck. And so I'm big on clearing out wherever you are so that I can be present and I can be more aware of the bigger picture and where God wants me to be. And then really, really working on the relationship I have with God and holding, knowing he's, he, she is holding my hand and I walk with Jesus holding me through this, knowing that, this is a struggle for me, but I'm walking with you, Jesus, and I know, we're walking together and I'm comforted on the path. So I do all kinds of things to help myself shift. It's not an easy process, and for women who aren't aware of all the things you can do, I think it's helpful to have wise counsel.
Well, yeah, and I think part of the problem, I'm not trying to make judgments here. My mom doesn't have that kind of a worldview. She doesn't, I'm not saying she's not going to survive when she dies. I hope, you know, I hope and pray that she does, and I believe most people will. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens. But I'm just saying,
I have to share a little story here, because I've had this as bad as any mother, I'm sure. And, you know, Arlene, I totally hear you. I mean, the sense of the, you know, we honor life. We struggle to bring it into the world, and we honor it so much. We have to nurture it so tenderly. Like you said, in utero on, it just is a focus. It's a constant focus of ours to bring this life, to make sure it's well and safe and healthy and happy. And it just becomes a magnificent obsession for women.
Great.
And I've been as obsessed as any of them, and I've sat at the window praying when my 16-year-old was out driving around in a snowstorm and, you know, couldn't sleep until they were inside the house, and, you know, couldn't even hardly breathe until I knew they were safe. And I had this experience one day. I mean, I used to just daily, I would give my children to Jesus, mm-hmm. or I would give them to the angels, I'd say. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, please, Master, you know, I'm at the end of my rope here, you take them, please. I don't know what else to do. I often frequently prayed to the angels. And this one day in particular, I was driving to work, and I was telling the angels yet again how much, you know, I hope that they'll watch over my children today and keep them safe. And you know, this world especially just kind of tends to make you a little more anxious than you would be maybe on a normal world that wasn't so dangerous. And so you really have to step out with faith and hope and pray that your children will be safe and okay. And mm-hmm. I was giving my children to the angels yet again, and I was saying, please, you know, just watch over them today. And, you know, I just love them so much. I love them so much. And I heard as clear as a bell, I heard the angels tell me, well, we love them too.
Right. I'll take it a step further, Paula. I'll take it a step further. Don't you think it's even more? I think it's even correct to say, if you know, Jesus and God love them more.
Well, that
they love them even more than you do.
Yeah, Andre, this is the insight I had. I immediately thought to myself, of course you do. Of course you do. You love them more than I do.
Right.
I thought. Sure. You have known me, but you've not only loved them, you love me, you love my mother, you love my mother's 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 mother, and my father's father. You know us going all the way back, and you can see us going all the way forward, and of course you love them. You love them more than I do. And believe it or not, I so released so much anxiety that day. And I mean, I really understood that when we are guarded by a seraphim, it's so much more than we ever imagine. And we just have to have faith that all things
work.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the faith issue is really what it boils down to, is having that faith, knowing that in this life and in eternity, you know, all is going to work out for the best, and that relationship you have with that or those children is an eternal relationship, and regardless of what happens in this one short lifetime, that your relationship with that child is one of eternity, and that's a faith issue. And if you have that, then I think that helps. That may not be the total solution, because there's always going to be some worry there, because there's always going to be some part of that parent-child relationship, regardless of how old your children get. But I think that if you have that faith, that gives you a more long-term perspective. And I think that helps relieve the worry, the stress, and all the, you know, all the negativity that you may think about during your worries.
And that brings, you know, me back to Jesus, because when we look at him and how he looked at someone and he saw the God in them, the good in them, and saw all their strengths and saw all their weaknesses, but saw their strengths. And so it helps me to see my children's strengths, to see their God and the God in them. And you know, maybe your mother, Andre, she knows you so well. I know she knows your strengths.
But wait, I can stop you for a second, Arlene. This is one of the things that frustrates me, because I'm not here to, like, rag on my mom and bash her, but the thing that frustrates me is sometimes I feel, and I've talked about this on the air before. I think that, unfortunately, I grew up in a dysfunctional family like many of us did. And I feel like my friends know me better. And for as much as my mom, you know, even though she's grown up with me, you know, I grew up, even though she's known me all these years, sometimes I feel like she really doesn't know me as well as my friends do. It's a very frustrating experience.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But I think from your end,
go ahead, Buck.
You know, I just think, Andre, from your end, and this is where I always get into it, especially, you know, in therapy sessions, is, you know, why do you allow that to upset you?
I'm not saying it really upsets me that much. It's just something it's just something that I struggle with sometimes. It actually doesn't upset me as much as it used to. But, you know, it's just.
But you're right.
You're right.
So you have to address that.
I have to share a quote here because it's just so, to me, this one really touches my heart. It's from the History of Your Ranch, a paper 84, Marriage and Family Life.
Yes.
Section 7, The Ideals of Family Life.
Right.
As civilization regards the parents as assuming all duties, the child as having all the rights. Respect of the child for his parents arises not in knowledge of the obligation implied in parental procreation, but naturally grows as a result of the care, training, and affection which are lovingly displayed in assisting the child to win the battle of life. And this is the part that I love, and I quote this to Mei Li often. The true parent is engaged in a continuous service ministry, which the wise child comes to recognize and appreciate. And, you know, I've noticed, and I know you guys have too, that continuous service ministry goes on beyond 18, 21, 25.
Absolutely.
You're always a parent.
It may not be as intense, but it is always there, and you always feel that connection and that desire to help your child, exactly what it said, win life's battles and you know, achieve. It just seems like it's a service ministry that never ends. And the key there is that the wise child comes to understand it and appreciate it for what it is. It is a service ministry. Go ahead, Buck. I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say one of the divine characteristics of God is as an upholder of the universe. And what is key about that for us as parents is consistency. In other words, the sun comes up over the eastern plains every morning where and when it's supposed to, doesn't it? Could you imagine how we would feel, what we would be thinking, what our behavior would be like if that didn't happen? I mean, we would be kind of crazy, wouldn't we? Well, to a large degree, the same thing happens with our children, because for all intent and purposes, especially when they're young, of course, we are God. We are deity to them, and so
right, exactly.
Until six,
we are deity, and so you know, so striving for that consistency. I mean, we can't because we're human, but striving for that consistency of service ministry, striving for that consistency of just being there, of just being in their presence, is perhaps the most important characteristic of parenting. It's just being consistent. I mean, you're going to be imperfect, and you're going to make mistakes. But as you said, they grow up and they get wiser and they recognize that you're imperfect and begin to be able to forgive some of those imperfections. And so part of what we teach children as we grow along is that capacity for forgiveness, which I think is perhaps one of the greatest gifts that we can give them. I just want to touch briefly on the importance of having regular family meetings, because
I think that
forgiveness issue comes out during those meetings. We had them consistently while our kids were growing up for years and years and years and years, and we actually took notes. Every decision that we made, we wrote down for obvious reasons. You know, you write it down and it's right there in black and white. They really became kind of neat family heirlooms. We still have them, these little notebooks. And, you know, we look at them and we say, oh, God, look at that funny stuff we were dealing with then. But that funny stuff that we were dealing with then was very, very important at that particular moment.
Yes.
And so what a child learns in family meetings is part of that consistency. And for the two parents to agree that having family meetings is crucial and critical for their family development is the most important thing. So if the parents agree, they're going to have the meetings. The children will try to sabotage it, of course. But,
well, you know, that's something that I've noticed in families often that aren't as successful is that when the parents are not together in their approach, then the children will drive a wedge. And I think
absolutely.
I think that's just
that's their job. That's their job.
Yeah, right. And, you know,
yeah, that's their job.
And I think just to tag on to the importance of family meetings, it's a critical process because we learn to make decisions cooperatively. It's not the majority rules, it's consensus. So that process of cooperating with people totally different than you are and coming to a consensus is critical. And we know from the Rancher book how important it is to make decisions, and more decisions sincerely made is part of the way we grow more spiritually and
right.
grow closer to God. So, you know, I can't say enough about the importance of coming together consistently as a family and making decisions about anything.
So essentially
let me ask you this, Arlene, or Buck, either one of you. I just want to go back to that passage that Paula just read. And by the way, I have neglected, I know the number's on the screen, folks, but I've neglected to give out our number for anybody who wants to call in. Anybody who wants to call in, to talk to Buck and Arlene, can reach us at 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158. I was going to ask you, the passage that Paula read from the Rancher book talks about how the respect for parental obligations, or the respect for the child's respect for the parent, naturally grows out of the care and affection that the child receives. This to me is so important because so many parents, I find, you know, do this kind of thing, like, you better respect me or you better appreciate what I do for you and that kind of stuff. It's like they want to demand respect instead of command respect. I guess what I'm trying to say is the best way to get respect from a child is by modeling it. You know, you get respect by giving respect. The child learns what they live. They learn, you receive love when you give love. And you know, so, you know, baby doesn't learn to love by a parent saying, you better love me. The baby learns to love by receiving love from the parent,
right.
responding in kind. How important is it, do you think, for parents to really model these kinds of behaviors rather than just saying, you know, do as I say, not as I do? You know?
Children always follow what we do, not what we say. I mean, that's an absolute, I won't make it that absolute, but that's pretty much what we all have experienced. You know, you say, don't do this, then the child looks at you and says, but you're doing it. You know, don't fight with your brother, but you're fighting with dad. You know, so
right.
we walk the walk rather than talk the talk with children. We do what we would like them to do. And I think, you know, that brings up the three different parenting styles that, and the one that Jesus showed us was the authoritative, showing the way rather than the authoritarian, which says, by fear, you do what I say because I'm the boss, I'm the parent. Or the passive parent, the laissez-faire parent who just isn't a guide. We'll say, you kids know what you need, you do your thing. Well, that doesn't say much for love. It says, you know, I'm out of here and you do your thing, and that child is has no direction and no guidance, and there needs to be that balance in the middle.
And really in a way, having both parents who are confident and a good partnership helps a person become a more balanced person.
Yes.
So that they can approach life from a variety of different strategies, and they're comfortable being, you know, taking different approaches, sometimes a feminine approach, sometimes a masculine approach. Every human being needs to strike that balance, I think, and having two good parents is probably the best way to grow up with that balance, you know, and see that balance and feel comfortable with that balance and understand that that's a good thing. Absolutely. I know you guys, I don't know how long you're going to be with us, but you want to take a call here?
Sure.
Okay. Hello, caller. You're on Blog Talk.
Hello?
Hello?
Hello? Hi, this is Joe. Joe, in California. Good, I've been
Hi,
on
Joe.
It. Hey, it's great to hear all you guys. I tried to log on, but I forgot my password. I couldn't get on, so I just called in. I think the show is great, and what I was wondering if you might address, it seems to me that the idea that, you know, the importance of the woman's perspective and the woman's personality and the gift that women have for mankind is becoming, you know, more pronounced, you know, with Hillary Clinton in the election and all the women that got behind her, world leaders, the women that are becoming world leaders. It seems like humanity is recognizing the complementary, divinity or aspect, divine aspect of a woman's equal but not the same
right.
participation in co-creating, you know, our humanity, our universe, and our world. And I just like so much what you guys are saying on how that sharing and cooperativeness and working together within a family creates a balanced picture for children and, you know, for everybody who is witnessing this cooperation between a man and a woman, a husband, a wife, a mother, a father, brothers and sisters, and I just want to thank you guys for doing that, and I'm enjoying the show.
Could I address that briefly?
Sure.
On page 564, the Uranus book says that a planet has not emerged from barbarism so long as one gender seeks to tyrannize the other. And then a place where the Michael and the universe mother spirit of Nebadon have a pledge of equality. And so, you know, for a mother and father to display that sense of equality, even though we're different, but to display that sense of unity and equality is, like Paula said, perhaps the greatest gift that we can offer our children, because they can see that and they can sense that and they can know it. And try as they may, they'll try to disrupt that. They'll try to put a wedge there, because they want, you know, they want everybody to be like them. So they're going to try to disrupt that unity. But to show them that you are together I think perhaps the greatest sense that you can give a child.
Yeah, and I'd like to add a little. Go ahead.
Yeah, please.
Jesus, when he was talking to his apostles who were, you know, struggling with the disciples of John the Baptist, you know, emphasized the importance of unity. We're all working to serve God here. We all love God, and we're all working to love each other and serve each other, rather than uniformity. We don't need to be the same. We're each wonderfully unique human beings, and to have everybody the same would be, wouldn't be solving universe problems very well if we're all on the same page. We're going to all either go down or go in the wrong direction, or maybe we'll get in the right direction. But that unity rather than uniformity is such a clear, important aspect to give our children and to work on and to respect that.
And, you know, Dr. Arlene, something you said earlier on in the show, it seems to me to be so important and so crucial as we raise young people with this this hope of becoming parents themselves and joining a family and being engaged in family life themselves, is the sense that marriage is not easy. It's like anything, like getting a degree or, obviously raising children or having a wonderful, meaningful career. None of these things are easy, but they're worth the effort. You know, it's like great motive that effort does not always produce joy, but there is no happiness without intelligent effort.
Right.
And I think that, you know, as the hardest things we ever do give us the most satisfaction, but they are hard. It's hard to stay married sometimes. It's seemingly easy to give up. on each other. But that,
on the short run.
Yes.
Right. And I think sometimes we do children, especially teenagers, as they're just surrounded with all of this sexual energy and the television and everywhere, the media, it's just there. But we do them a disservice if we don't help them realize that this is all for a purpose, and the purpose is to procreate, and the purpose is to bring children into the world. And what a responsibility that is for a mother and father to be equally responsible in a partnership for that child, that new being that comes in, and that you can't just give up on that child once it's here, and you can't give up on each other. And marriage is a very serious thing, and I think we do, you know, culturally, I would love to see us really tackle making families better. And you know, doing that, I think that has to be done at the educational level for boys and girls. And,
But you know, I've got to get on a soapbox here though for a minute because I'm very good at that though. one of the things that this is not to contradict anything anybody has said here, because I totally value and believe in the complementary natures of men and women. I do think though, and maybe I'm seeing this through rose-colored glasses because I haven't been married. I do think there is a way, though, not to eliminate, but to minimize the difficulties of marriage. And here's how I think it can be done. I think that one of the greatest ways to prevent divorce is to make sure the wrong people don't get married. Paul, I think you mentioned that a while ago. How do you make sure the kids don't marry the wrong person? I think one thing that people often do, one of the mistakes people often make is they marry their opposite. You know, there's this whole thing, opposites attract. I have a friend who says, opposites attract, but similar stay together. You know, and again, I realize that men and women are complementary, but that's not the same thing as opposite. I personally will not date a person. I'll not date a woman unless we have more in common than we do, not in common. Because, I mean, if I'm only interested in dating someone if I could see myself potentially married to them. And if I'm going to marry someone, you know, I'm going to spend the rest of my life with that person. I better make darn sure that, you know, that we have more in common than not. Because, you know, otherwise it's just going to produce misery. And I think that, you know, and as much as it does take hard work, yes, I think one of the things that makes for a good relationship is a certain kind of flow, a certain kind of synergy, so that, you know, 90% of the time you are flowing on the same page so that you have a foundation, so that when you do get into those times when you have to resolve conflict and you have to work through things, you know, you it's worthwhile. Because you have that foundation to, you know, to work from. I mean, I guess how important do you think it is?
Yeah, I really like to speak to that.
Mm-hmm.
I think first let me tell you that Buck and I are very different. Okay, very different, and we were attracted to each other in our 20s for all kinds of reasons. And our relationship has not been, oh yeah, we're both of us like, we'll agree real fast. No. We are very strong in our differences, and studies show that when you are different, you have to work on the relationship more. You put more energy into it. However, if you're the same, it's an easier relationship, and you may have energy, you know, to do other things. So I don't totally agree with that, but I do think that if it wasn't for the spiritual values that we hold, our relationship would have been very difficult, and we may not have made it. That's the core. In all the best, counseling for couples who aren't making it, if you have that spiritual base, whatever it is, you both have a spirit, you get beyond your human emotions and your fears and your shame and your hurts. Yeah, you can express them and your angers. But then you're going to go to, okay, what does God want me to do here in this situation? What's the highest good? And when Buck and I shifted from pretty much a godless relationship to having God in our life, that's when things got to manifest. That's when things shifted. Then we could come together and say, okay, we don't agree. You know, and our boys will laugh at us at us many times because we fight over little details because we are both very strong-willed. We have our ideas and we're, you know, very clear about them. And so we have worked very hard on that. So it does not always have to be the same, but I think we need to have that unity in wanting to do what God wants us to do in this situation. What is the highest good? And it's not always clear, but at least we're on the same page.
Suggest, Arlene, I'm not trying to rain.
I know. I know you
to rain on your relationship. I'm just telling you that I think that one of the things, I don't know if you're aware of, there's a website that's online a lot. It's a dating site. It's called eHarmony.
Right.
One of the things that I know the guy who founded it, his name is Neil Clark Warren, and he's a really great guy. One of the things that they try to do is they try to make sure that you have as much, he says similarities and differences are like assets and liabilities. You know, you want to make sure you have as much money in the bank, you know, so to speak, as possible. But I guess what I'm saying here is, you know, a lot of people say, well, the problem with our society is people don't want to commit. They don't want to work hard. That's why we have so much divorce. And I think there's something that has to come before commitment, and it's called compatibility. And I think because if you didn't have compatibility, then it wouldn't matter who you married.
And I agree with that. And I also want to add that the foundation of the relationship is emotional dependency, being supportive and there for each other when you need it. That's the core. Compatibility is very helpful. Cooperation is very helpful. But it's the emotional support, the emotional intimacy.
We have another caller, you guys. Hold on.
See what happens when I give the phone number out on the air?
514, you're on Blog Talk.
Hi, everyone. This is Diane LeBrec.
Hey, Diane.
Hi, Diane. Hi, I just wanted to say three things. I felt absolutely compelled to call to share three things with you. Mm-hmm. Number one, I would like to say that Buck and Arlene, it is so, absolutely so beautiful to listen to you that it made me feel, and I'm speaking from my heart, so if you want to laugh, go ahead, but this is my true feeling. I felt, my God, these are such good parents. I could actually hear the beauty of your souls as you were talking, and I felt if I was a child again, I would love to call you mom and dad. It's like being my surrogate spiritual parent, you know? It is so beautiful. And I mean this. The second thing is I loved when you both started the program by talking about, but you talked about the Heavenly Father being a representation to the child from the Father. And Arlene, you spoke about space and Mother Spirit, and if we are close to the Mother, socially, how we behave. So from personal experience with my own son, Jonathan, whom I love to say, you are my beloved son, he's been very, very close to me. And today, becoming a young man, I see how beautifully, how beautiful he acts socially with people. So when you said that, it just reassured me by saying, oh, wow, this is great. We've had a great relationship, him and me, and look how great he's behaving socially with people. Mm-hmm. But the beauty that the pearl I want to share is that Jonathan, my son, had a difficulty with his father from the start, and he was not connected to God the Father very much. And to spare you a long story, things happened over the years, and not too long ago, a few months ago, as the answer of my prayer to Jesus, all of a sudden one day his father called after being absent for many years. And he started to reconnect with his father. And I saw a balance happen in my son. But the most amazing thing is that just a few weeks ago, he started to talk about God the Father to me.
Beautiful.
And he started to explain how he never reads. He's a real hands-on person. And he started to talk to me about, hey, you know, Mom, when I die, if I survive, you know, I would love to think of it this way and that, and I would love to think of God the Father as an all-loving Father, and he understands our mistakes. I was just about, it's a good thing my arms were screwed on my body because they would have fallen on the ground. I could not believe it.
Beautiful.
And I saw the balance with his father, the harmony coming back to him, and then him coming out of the blues talking about God and heaven and survival and Jesus. And it was, so when you said that, Buck, it was wonderful. And also in the Urantia book, when they tell us the story about Cain and Abel, that if he had survived past about the moment of 25 years and older, all the good upbringing would have resurfaced.
Right.
And that's exactly right. What happened with my son Jonathan, because I raised him so certifiedly organic, you know, that through adolescence he had to go through his ups and downs. But just about 26 years old, he sort of resurfaced, and all the good upbringings that I had him received started to come out without me asking him. So this is most important. And the third thing I wanted to share is that as part of one of the training that I took in my naturopathic field and studies, I wanted to share with the listeners a gift that may help others as well. And this is that I took a course. I became a practitioner in the Dr. Bach, Edward Bach's flower remedies. And today I can honestly say from my heart and soul that I'm sure I took that course first and foremost to heal myself. Because when I was pregnant of my son, actually the night I conceived Jonathan, I knew what I was doing. The night his father kissed me, we had been together for 7 years, and I said to him, if we make love tonight, we're going to conceive a baby love, because I just know it. And so his father, now today, knowing that men respond from a different point of view, that night his father said, well, let's make love and conceive a baby love, which we did 2 weeks later when I showed up at the drugstore with my urine test and said, can you confirm that I'm pregnant? He looked at me. I was very young, like very just about 20 years old. So he said, my God, you look like you're sure of yourself. I said, yes, I know. I just need the confirmation. So, yes, indeed, I was pregnant. But what I want to say is that for whatever reason, at about 3 months pregnant, you know, in genetics, just when it's time for the fetus to turn into another phase, because it's a phase of 1 to 3 months, and then 3 to 6, and then 6 to 9, just about at that phase, one night his father called me, and after 7 years said he never wanted to be with me again, and not only this, he didn't want the child. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not for me to judge him. I mean, he will have to fix that with his Heavenly Father. But at the same time, it literally, totally, completely traumatized me, because that child had been conceived of love. And so for almost 20 years, I had a pathology. I can say now it was an actual pathology, that I was totally stuck to Jonathan, and having gone through this difficult time of, I cannot describe how difficult it is for a woman to not only be dumped like that, but also to be said that you don't want the child. And he said, why don't you go for an abortion? And the day, I'm sharing this only if it can help people, the day I went to the abortion doctor, because I was almost like hypnotized, it had traumatized me so much over the phone that it was almost like a programming. So I booked an appointment and I went to the abortion clinic. And when I got there with my beloved sister, Marie, I was crying like a Magdalene, you know. And I remember being in the doctor's office with my legs open. And then he said, why are you crying so much? This is going to take nothing. 10 minutes, vacuum cleaner. I'm going to pull this thing out and it'll be over. And at that moment, I literally heard a little tiny voice coming from the depths of my soul, almost like yelling, no, don't, but it was so faint, you know, like, don't. And I just closed my legs and I got up and I said, nobody on earth will take that child away from me. I got dressed and I walked out of that clinic, and my sister said, Diane, you should have seen yourself when you opened the door. You look like a rock of Gibraltar. You had like the sun right behind you and you were like immovable, except it had traumatized me. And for years and years, I was so overly protective with my son. And when I took my course as a Bach practitioner, I found out that there were some remedies, because Dr. Bach, being a very eminent doctor in those days, in those years, found out that food is to the body what flowers, the essence of flowers, are to the emotions. And when you think of it, think of the roses. It brings emotion up to you, emotions of love and care and, you know, the appreciation from the person who gives them to you. So I took the whole course, became a practitioner as part of my naturopathic profession, and I started to treat myself. And I thought, if this is to work really, I'm going to see. And I took one remedy that really helped me. And after 20 years of trauma, one day after about 3 months of that treatment, I was totally over this. And today I can say that I've become normal, and I mean normal within quotes, but wholesome mother, totally loving my son, but not being so affected and traumatized as before. So if any people know, you know, practitioners that can help them with the Bach flower remedies, it truly loves and it truly works. And in complementary service, as like having wonderful people like you, Buck and Arlene, as psychotherapists to help people, every little help we can get as mothers to be better parents for our children is important. And this is the reason why I called, because I suffered so much from that. And God knows, like I said to Jonathan, you know, after God, I'm the one who loves you the most. And don't worry, I'm standing quite close to him, you know, so there's no competition. But at the same time, now I feel free that he can live his life. And as you said, Andre, it can be buggy, because Jonathan used to say to me, Mom, leave me alone. I know you love me. But I couldn't help it. I couldn't help it, because it was a trauma that, and I knew what the problem was, but I couldn't get over it. Like an old record, I would get stuck in the same groove. And I finally succeeded in uprooting that bad weed that had built inside me from an emotional trauma. So I wanted to share that.
Thank you so much, Diane.
Hey,
and
hey,
thank
Buck, Arlene, I think Diane brings up a really good point, and Bro Dave asked a question on the board a little bit ago. So two things. The question about the benefit or disadvantage of being an only child, and then the other thing is how can we help single parents who are struggling? You know what? If you're a mom, if there's a mom out there listening right now and she's struggling like Diane struggled, what can maybe somebody do to help? What can she do to help her child become more balanced? If there's no father figure in that child's life,
well, most of the studies, I'll just start a little bit, show that having an advocate for you, you know, as a child, will help you with life and be resilient. And so if you don't have the father in the home, then you look for an advocate, you look for a surrogate, you know, male in some ways, whether it's the grandfather or the uncle, or just get a foster grandparent or someone, you know, they have all these programs for you know, older people to help younger people. So I encourage that direction, to have some kind of male model in their life that is a positive force.
First of all, realize how important it is, and go out and find that for your child.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One of the most controversial statements in the Urantia book for me was, and again it surrounds John Mark, when I think John Mark had a friend and the two of them came to Jesus to ask if they could be assistants or be of help somehow with the work that he was doing, and ultimately Jesus chose John Mark because of his family background. And I think the other young gentleman didn't have a father.
He was an only child, and his parents were overprotective, and they fought a lot. And for him to become his own person, he had to break relationships with those parents. And so that was, I thought, the most you know, detrimental part, because he had to break a relationship, hurt a relationship with his parent in order to be his own individual self.
And you know what, you guys, and I want to make sure, and I don't have any intention of disparaging single mothers at all, because I know that there are plenty of single mothers who do a good job, but I do want to address this epidemic of fatherlessness, because we read so much about it in the newspaper and everything. What is it doing to children? You know, what is it? What is not having a father? What is that? And it's particularly boys. You know, I want to address how this is affecting boys, because, you know, for years, again, feminists have been saying, oh, you know, girls don't get called on in school as much as boys, and girls are being damaged academically, which I think is kind of ridiculous, because more girls go to college than boys. So actually, clearly, more boys are dropping out of high school, more they're committing suicide, you know, that kind of thing. So how is this epidemic of fatherlessness affecting, you know, not just boys, but, you know, children in general? How does it affect boys? How does it affect girls?
Well, first I'd like Buck to finish what his thought was, and I'm sorry I interrupted because he didn't complete his thought, so I appreciate hearing what Buck had to say.
Well, I think the thought was, essentially, and maybe it wasn't that instance, but there was a time where essentially he said that having that kind of a background affects that child's complete afterlife. Now, they use the word afterlife, so I think the controversy has been whether they mean the rest of his human life after childhood or his eternal life. And so, but I thought for sure it centered around having a father or not having a father. So I think that what, to get back to Andre's question there, is that, you know, the Urantia book does a very good job of presenting God as a father. Now, you know, even, and I'm really still surprised to this day that even many Urantia book readers kind of take offense to that sometimes. But I think that if I were a woman, I would advocate fatherly love. And fatherly love is important because it's different than motherly love. Motherly love is natural.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what mother could not love their child? You know, as fathers, in order for a father to love their child, it requires of that man something extra, something more, something different. Whatever that difference is, whatever that extra is, that's like the second mile. And that's what I think children are missing today, that they don't have that sense of fatherly love. They're missing that second mile love. They're missing that complete concept of fatherly love. What the world needs most is fatherly love. Motherly love is abound. Where can you not find motherly love? But fatherly love is a whole different aspect of a person's being.
How do you explain mothers then who neglect their kids and abuse them? And I mean, you know, that kind of thing.
You want to be absolute, of course. Those are,
yeah,
who've been abused. And,
sure. Yeah, I mean, but that's exceptions. I mean, there are exceptions to every rule, and that's why there's rules. So
certainly
that's the case. But I think, you know, the preponderance of motherly love is abound. I mean, where can you, I mean, it's like motherly love, all I addressed it earlier, you know, it's just so natural, you know, that you
right.
You know, it's just part of your being.
You have to beat it out of that in a sense.
Yeah, but a father could have children all over the world and not even know it. Is there a mother that could do that? but for a father to say, okay, I'm going to choose to love this child, then that requires of that man something extra, something more. And that's the premise, I believe, of the whole concept of fatherly love. And that is what the world needs most, is fatherly love. I think, you know,
that is an invaluable insight to me. It really, really is. Jesus said over and over again, the kingdom of heaven is in the hearts of men. And I think in some respects, you know, it really strikes at the heart of why are there so many mothers, and we got into this, Andre, when we were doing our last show on this subject, why so many women are out there raising their children alone, and why men don't take responsibility as much for their children. Of course, a woman can't say it's not my child, but it seems like somehow culturally we have to help young men feel that love for their children and feel comfortable expressing the love of their hearts for their children. I mean, almost in a sense, it's like, you know, we're saying if a man expresses his love, then that's a weakness. And it's just, it's sad to me that, you know, we don't allow men to be more emotional. I mean, I think men have tear ducts too. Men want to cry. Men feel emotions just like women do. But society, you know, culturally, it's not acceptable. And to me, that is so sad. And it almost stops them from being in their hearts, and or from allowing themselves to go to their hearts. And, you know, if the kingdom of heaven is in their hearts, as Jesus said, then, you know, we have to find a way to honor that aspect of boys. Honor their,
can I add something?
Yes, absolutely.
I would like to add something and then let you continue with this most healthy and wholesome discussion interview. It's so beautiful. Thank you. The last thing I feel inspired to add is on a very down-to-earth ground, in my studies in naturopathy, it corresponds with what the Urantia book tells us, and they do say that our sources, our roots, are from the sea, from the oceans. And we know that the oceans contain minerals. And I was most happy to find out in one of my studies that when they tell us in the Urantia book the progression of how we did, how we emerged from the oceans down up to Earth and then what we are today, and we know the kind of state of the Earth right now, there's very big instability in terms of nutrition, and fortunately, the fashion is into certified organic foods. And one of the world's famous authority is Dr. Bernard Jensen. And Dr. Jensen, of all his, I think he wrote nearly 60 books on medicine and naturopathy and health. And one of the encyclopedia is called The Chemistry of Man. And in his book, he mentions the importance of minerals. And they've even done tests and found out that some women that were lacking, because each of the elements we know were back to chemistry, the earth, creation. And he describes that each mineral has a very particular function on the human being. And I think it's in conjunction with spirit and mind. And he says, he describes that some women have been tested, and when they were low in very specific mineral, they had no motherly instinct whatsoever. And I'm saying this because you asked, Andre, what do we do? How can we help women that don't seem to have such a strong motherly instinct? And I just realized that when we do get a full supplement of the whole spectrum of minerals, we give our body the balance, the harmony, the wholesomeness of equilibrium, which brings a good behavior in us, and not only on the physical point of view, but even on the mental point of view. And even Dr. Linus Pauling, who won 2 Nobel Prizes, I think he's the only Nobel Prize winner who's been a double winner at Nobel Prize, said, all disease is a lack of minerals. And then I took it from that, meaning that the Urantia book says we originate from the sea. And today I see such an imbalance at certain levels on Earth with people, with society, with behavior and all this, and we're all searching for answers. But at the same time, there is such a thing as balance, and we must not forget the physical as well. And if we do have the privilege to have a good, wholesome spiritual life combined with a good, wholesome physical life and a good teammate like Buck and Arlene, you've been saying, then it can help bring a balance, and then the children are the benefactors of that, you know. So I just felt like adding this, and then I'm going to let you say goodbye and thank you. And
thank you, Diane.
Thank you so much for the program.
Thank you for your offerings.
Oh, thank you, Mom and Dad. Bye, everyone.
Bye. I'm going to need to end pretty soon here. I have other commitments. So, you know, we can maybe wrap it up if we could.
You bet. Well, I just want to add that, you know, on the heels of what Diane said, that I think that if, and what Buck said, I think that if fathers took more of a responsibility, because I think that women a lot of times are just overwhelmed. And that's, and when you're overwhelmed, you're stressed. And when you're stressed, you're not as good of a parent, you're not as good of a spouse,
absolutely,
you're not as good of a human being.
Yeah, I don't know how single mothers do it.
Don't either. And you know, you can say, you know, because you raised your sons with such a great partner, and I had a partner to help me raise my children, and he was such an adorable man and a sweet man. I can't imagine what it's like for single moms to have to raise their children alone. And sometimes, you know, you can be married and still be raising your children alone because you have a son who doesn't participate with you.
Right.
And the same with single dads. I mean, you know, when you see a single parent, you have to understand that they're under stress, and it's because it's a hard job. It takes two, and to have a partner in that very difficult job is essential for the children and for the parental, you know, health and parental mental health. So, you know, that could be why. I think once you get stressed, that can cause a lot of chemical imbalances too. And
well, and then there's the whole issue, and I don't want to get into too much of it, but we have so much addiction in this society.
Mm.
And that
yeah.
is a huge issue in terms of parental neglect and abuse.
Right.
So that's a whole other show we can talk about, that one,
yeah.
and how it affects families. That we
and,
really
and another
really
issue
to address that. Go ahead, Buck.
Well, I was going to say another issue we didn't address that we could certainly spend a lot of time on is the issue of discipline.
Yeah.
Disciplining children. I think it's a huge issue in family life, and of course males usually take a very different approach to it than females do. Men tend to be a little bit more stern about it, I think, than women. Women tend to be a little bit more lenient about it. Again, on general, now there's no absolutes like Arlene said, but so men tend to be a little bit more stern about it, and so just generally speaking, I think that's another important issue of family life that has to be dealt with up front, and it's another issue where, you know, again, the parents need to come together on. As long as they're together on what they're doing and how they're doing it, I think that's absolutely crucial.
And we need to remember that the definition of discipline is to teach, to show the way. Not,
right.
you know, punish.
Well, and it comes from the same root word as disciple.
Yeah, right.
You know, to teach. You know, what is a disciple? A disciple is a student. So you want to student your children and to make them,
right.
to turn them into students, you know.
Right.
Sure.
Right.
And you're teaching them how to be, how to be an individual, and at the same time, teaching them, and the greatest shift that child makes in their development, and you can see it in children if you're aware of it, is that they have to make their ego adjustment to become part of the group, whether it's the three of you or four of you or five of you,
mm-hmm.
ever how many it is, because a child is naturally egocentric, and they should
right.
be. They're naturally egocentric. I mean, that's natural, and it's normal. But then for them to make that shift or make that adjustment to begin to see the importance and making decisions for the welfare of the whole or the welfare of the family is truly, truly one of the great joys of family life. I always remember my youngest son, Adam, he was struggling with something. I forgot what it was anymore, but he was struggling with something with one of his brothers, and he said, "Well, you just wait till Sunday. I'm going to bring that up at the family meeting." So, you know, for him at his young age that he was at that time, for even to be thinking that way was just, you know, truly a joy, you know, to hear that and watch that and observe that. So,
and family life is truly a joy, and the Arantia book tells us that we learn those all important lessons of altruism and cooperation, and you know, I mean, you just don't learn that anywhere like you learn it in a loving family or in a family that's striving to, you know, find peace and
right.
and understanding and cooperation. And you know, those are the lessons that are invaluable in every aspect of life, and they're learned in the family first.
And that's
why it's so important.
Yeah. I was going to say, and that's why a lot of children today who don't have that solid family attachment. They're attracted to gangs.
Yes, yes.
We talked about that actually.
Yes, I know we talked about that a few weeks ago, in fact, on our show. That's particularly true, again, going back to the fatherlessness issue, you know, with male young boys, you know, not having. It's really interesting, you know, when boys don't have order and consistency and discipline at home, it's interesting that, you know, what is it that you know, a gang gives them that, and it gives them that in a very rigid, orderly. It's funny because a lot of people think of gangs as being chaos and out of control, and they are in a sense, but on the other hand, they're also extremely rigid and hierarchical. So it's kind of funny, you know, that it's like if they don't get it at home, then they're going to go to the other extreme and you know, and try to create it.
Yeah. Well, the need for belonging is a critical need, and that's, you know, if they don't get it from the family, they're going to go to outside the family.
You know, and I have to point out that, and I know you have to leave, Arlene, but I read a book that was very important to me. It was called Reviving Ophelia.
Yes.
Because
I read that.
Yeah. Wonderful.
I had a teenage daughter who was, you know, growing up, and I'm so glad I read it, and I highly recommend it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a person who did many, many, a psychologist, I guess, you did many, many case studies of young women and what their issues were as they became, left from, like, their childhood into their young adulthood, like, say, grade school into junior high, and how some of them just went wacky when the thing that she identified over and over again was that they felt abandoned. They felt like they had not been prepared for the kind of sexual energy and tension that was going to, you know, be directed at them, and they felt defenseless. They didn't know what to do about it. And what struck out to me was the two children, in all the case studies she did, the two children that didn't seem to be bothered by these problems at all were one, a girl that came from a very strong Christian family where mother and father were everything we've been describing. They were very tight with each other. They were very together on their approach. They had a strong faith. And everybody knew what the rules were in the family. There was a good structure in the family. If you broke the rules, the discipline was swift and sure. It was unequivocal. Everybody knew what was expected of them. This was the really well-adjusted child. And the other child that was really well-adjusted, in all the case studies she did in this book, was the Asian child who came from a single mom family, her and her little brother and her mom. But she was very naturally devoted to her family. And she would leave school every day and go home to her mother and her little brother. So she was naturally very family-oriented, and Asians have very tight family. So I just thought that was really interesting that, again, that the children that were well-adjusted were the ones that had a very strong family structure. And the ones that felt, thrown out to the wolves, so to speak, were the ones that a lot of them were in these families where, you know, it was kind of we just felt like she was going to be fine, you know, give them love and water and they'll grow, that kind of thing, you know, a very laissez-faire, laid-back attitude towards raising their children. And these children were the ones that struggled facing adulthood more than any other. So that's an interesting book to read if you're a parent of a girl. But even in any respect, I think just what you and Buck have said, you know, that tight mother and father bond and a strong faith and a good structure that children can count on.
The consistency, yes. The love and the structure, those two aspects are really critical. You know,
yeah.
And that's where the authoritative approach is so important.
Yeah. Listen, I know that, Arlene, you need to go, and Buck, I don't want to keep you here forever because we're going, I think we went over the two-hour mark, the hour mark. I didn't hear my clock go off, but I'm sure we have. So, but I just want to thank you guys both again for being on with us, and it's been a real pleasure and a joy, and I hope that we'll do it again sometime. And, you know, again, thanks for helping us continue this thread on family.
And thank you for inviting us. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you, Andre.
I really feel, Grace, that you are doing this service. This is a wonderful service that you and Paula are doing. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We enjoy it so much.
Thank you, Paula.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay. Well, God bless, and you have a great
day.
Okay,
God bless you both, and thank you so much again.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye. Absolutely. Thank you for coming on.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Bye.
Well, Paula, doesn't you just feel privileged to be able to talk to these kind of people. I mean, it's just great. It's great that we have people like this in our community. I mean, it's like our—I feel like our community of readers is such a—it's such a wealth of knowledge and wisdom. And I mean, it's like we never have a hard time getting. Well, I shouldn't say never, because I have had a hard time getting guests the last few weeks. But there's just so many people out there who have so much that's worth listening to say, you know.
And yeah, and they certainly are. I mean, like I said, you know, if you see them together and you watch them operate and you hear some of the stories of, you know, they're just endlessly insightful about raising their children. And it's you know, I think we need to, Andrea. I think we need to inspire each other, because these things that seem to be commonplace, things like having a family, being married, they're not. They're hard. They're difficult. And we need to offer each other practical, encouraging advice to help succeed in that, because it's not an easy thing. And, you know, Buck and Arlene are ever an example of that. I mean, they just are. And it's really wonderful to know them and have known them all these years. And you're right. We do have a rich community. And it's a diverse community, and God bless us for celebrating diversity. I'm so glad we do, you know, and it's just fantastic. It is an honor to have guests like them on our show. We're lucky to be able to associate with such fine people.
How much time do we have left?
We have 21 minutes.
Okay. If anybody wants to call in again and talk to us here for the remainder of the show, please do. Our number again is 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158. In the meantime, maybe we could do you have a song we could play, Paula?
Oh, sure.
Why don't we do that? Maybe someone, while we're doing that, if anybody wants to call in, please feel free. After the music, we can chat some more with all of you, and please feel free to give us a buzz here at the Cosmic Citizen.
I'm looking for a song. Hold on.
Okay.
Here's a great one. Here's a great one that's so true. This is by Pato Benton. It's about the birth of his grandchild. Life.
Excellent.
In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and God said, let there be light. The light. Oh, life is a miracle. Oh, life. Oh, life is a miracle. It's a miracle every time a mother gives birth. Tell me who can say how much a child is worth. A miracle living on this planet Earth, rotating to the rhythm of the universe. Life more precious than the rarest stone, more valuable than silver or gold. Life, the essence is invisible to the scientific mind, it's impossible. Like the secret of the seed that grows into a tree, the starry galaxies remain a mystery. Oceans and the seas, the air we breathe, God knows that I believe. Life is a miracle. Life, oh life. Life is a miracle. Oh life. Life, oh life. Life is a miracle. As I turn one page of our history, I see so many great personalities, like Marcos, Messiah, Garvey, Emperor Selassie, and the great Bob Marley. Malcolm X with any means necessary. Martin Luther marching to victory. Mother Teresa, Princess Diana, even Tupac Shakur and the one Daddy Biggie. Well, they will always have a place in our memory. And in time to come, you wait and see, they will all get the gift of eternity. God knows that I believe. Life is a miracle. paradise. We thank you, Jah, for the gift of life. And though this world is filled with trouble and strife, in time to come it will be worth the price. Life, the journey of experience, by growing we secure our deliverance. Life, the phenomenon, the prodigy, the marvel of an undiscovered destiny. So let's give thanks to our Father above for all of the wonderful things that He does. Life is the ultimate gift of love. God knows that I believe, yes I do. Life is a miracle, it's true. Life, oh life, life is a miracle.
Oh life,
life, oh life,
life is a miracle.
Life, oh life, life is a miracle.
Oh life,
life, oh life,
life is a miracle.
To paradise.
Well, Paula, you managed to pick my favorite Pacho Banton song because that's the one I like the most. So,
I love that one, too. Hey, and guess what? We have a caller.
I knew it. I knew it. I knew if we just took a break and played a song like professional radio people, we would have a caller. So we have to convince everybody that we're really not amateurs. Anyway, who is on the air with us?
816, you're on Blog Talk.
Yeah, hi. This is Lee in Missouri.
Hey, Lee, there you are.
Hey, Lee.
Hi. I had two things I wanted to say, but I wanted to ask a big favor first because I have attention deficit disorder, and so I wanted to be able to say all of it without being interrupted because I just lose my train of thought when I'm interrupted, and sometimes people don't know I'm not done talking, you know. So I thought, this is how I'm going to say it and say it all, and then I'll be done, and you can take other callers if that's okay. So here's my two things. One is that I wanted to piggyback on an earlier comment Paula made about, that you made, Paula, about, you know, trusting God about your children. And what I wanted to say was another reader helped me with that one time a few years ago when I was going through really icky, hard, scary times with one of my sons. And I was just basically drowning in fear and pity and anxiety. And the reader it was a father, a male who's a father, and he just said one thing to me, which was so shocking that it completely got me over the hump. He said, "Don't you believe anything the book says about how much God loves everyone?" And it was like, it was the best thing that anybody could have said to me was to challenge me on not believing the book, because, of course, I think I believe the book, you know, but I wasn't applying it in that particular situation. And so that's what I thought of when you talked about your similar, you know, recognition, Paula. And then the second thing is that, Andre, I wanted to pick up on something you had said earlier, too, about, you know, the challenge of growing up in a dysfunctional family, which I did, and of having, you know, sometimes difficulties with parents. And I happen to be, like, really disconnected from my mother, and so I didn't have a good, you know, self-concept. And that has really been a hardship for a lot of my life. But I actually talked to Buck about this a few years ago, and Buck said to me the same thing he said on the air today, which is that I needed to forgive my parents. And I think it was, you know, a little easier for me in the sense that my parents are deceased. Both of them
were.
Yes,
I agree.
Yeah, even at the time I asked him, they were. And so, but that still seemed like a very enormous task. And he said, no, give yourself about 5 years, like, so that, you know, it's good to have, like, a timeline, so at least you know you're working on it. It's not like, oh, I'll forgive them sometime before I die, because then you might not work on it. And so, anyway, I started, and it was really all uphill for, terribly uphill for like the first 6 months or so, and then it started getting a little bit easier. But what I just came to this year was I had to forgive myself for judging them. That was huge. Once I got to that and I started looking at them after having forgiven myself for judging them, then forgiving them was way easier. But it took me maybe 5 years to get to that, Andre.
Well, you know, it's funny because I agree, and I want you to stay on the phone. I know you said you want to take other call, want to take other calls. I'd like you to stay on the phone here because I really want to just dialogue with you about this a little bit because I think it's really important what you're saying. I think it's really, really important for us to be able to forgive our parents. I think it's extremely important. But what I think happens sometimes, and I'm not saying you're doing this or Buck did this to you, but I think sometimes people put pressure on victims of abuse or family dysfunction. Well, why don't you just forgive them, you know, as if they can do it overnight. And I'm glad that Buck gave you a nice long timeline of 5 years. I think you're absolutely right that it's easier when they're deceased because I know that I was able to finally forgive my dad. And the biggest reason I was able to forgive him is because he wasn't around to continue to inflict emotional pain on me. You know? So it's harder when the person is alive if they're not willing to acknowledge their wrong. You know, it's very difficult if they continue to do the same things over. And believe me, I've tried confronting my mom over and over and over about the way she's treated me, and she just doesn't want to change, you know. So luckily, my mom is with her husband right now, which is great because when she's with her husband, she's just not the same person she is when she's, I don't know if it's that she needs a man around or what, I don't know, but it's just a much more harmonious relationship. They don't live together. It's a weird situation. But anyway, I think the thing that makes, I was talking to Paul about this some time ago. One of the things I want to do sometime, I want to do a workshop on this at a conference, or maybe we could even do a show on this. The theme is I want to forgive, but I don't know how. And this has really been crucial for me because, to me, I think one of the reasons it's so hard for us to forgive people sometimes is because the Erasmus book makes it very clear that we can't really love someone until we understand them. And I think that's why it's so easy for God to forgive us, because God understands us completely. And so, and it's hard to understand people, though, if they don't let you into their head, if they don't tell you, well, this is what I'm dealing with, this is what I'm struggling with. You know, I mean, I'm sure you probably have this experience, both you, Lee and Paula, where, you know, you have this experience where someone said, you know, someone does something to hurt you or says something to hurt you, and you find out later that they had a really bad day or that something really traumatic has just happened to them or whatever. And you're able to see that, you're able to see that wider picture, that wider horizon, just like the Erasmus book tells us, you know, about the caveman story, you know, that we're, you know, first you just see the caveman, the dirty, smelly caveman, and then you see the saber-toothed tiger in front of him and two children and a woman behind him, you know. So I think that the understanding thing is really crucial. And one of the things that happened when after my father died is I talked to my uncle, who was my father's brother, who helped me understand my dad. You know, but that's just... that's a process. I don't think we can just forgive by turning on a switch. You know, it's not like you can just choose to forgive the way you choose to brush your teeth. You know, or I mean, and that's why the Erasmus book says you can't just love your neighbor by an act of the will. You have to go. It requires a thoroughgoing understanding of your neighbor's motives and sentiments. And I think the same thing is true of forgiveness.
Yeah, and
you know,
you
both have had issues with your parents, and I'm wondering because as a parent. You know, I know, and I also know some parents who have estranged children, and that's a deep, deep sorrow for them. Oh my gosh, they suffer for that, and they would even tell you, I know I made mistakes, but they don't know how to fix it. I'm wondering, from both of you, what could either one of your parents have done to you that you would say, you know what, it's okay, I forgive you, and let's move on. I love you. I want to have a relationship with you.
Why don't you start that, Lee?
Well, if I'm understanding the question correctly, Paula, you're saying what could my parents
do? What could your parent have done to help you get over the hurts?
If they had taken responsibility for anything and ever said once in their entire lives that they were wrong, because I was always the one that was wrong, you see.
Yeah.
And I think probably we were both wrong, you know. And so it was really hard.
If they had just said to you, Lee, I was wrong and I'm sorry
yeah.
I hurt you or whatever.
Yeah,
just
I agree with that. I agree with that because, you know, that's all it would take. You know, my dad never apologized. I never heard the words "I'm sorry" come out of his mouth, ever. You know, I mean, and my mom, to her credit, has apologized to me before, but then there were times when I tried to get her to apologize and she wouldn't. And I'm so convinced of this, and I think you guys would both agree with this. I'm so convinced that, you know, it may sound on the air like sometimes like I have all this resentment towards my mom, but, you know, not only do I love my mom, but, you know, I think that almost all children, unless they're total sociopaths or something, I think almost all children, whether they're children or adults, want that relationship with their parents. They want that unconditional love. They want that, you know, and I think if parents, you know, if more parents were willing to just admit, you know what, I screwed up, I'm sorry, I did the wrong thing. That, I mean, I just know for me, that's all it would take, you know. And it seems so simple, but yet it's so difficult for people.
No, I agree. I absolutely agree with you, and I think that it's an interesting dilemma because oftentimes the person who's in the authority or the person who has the upper hand has the hardest time.
Yeah.
Humbling themselves and saying, I'm sorry. But I think that it's kind of a shallow victory to forgive somebody who never craved your forgiveness. You know what I mean? It's okay, but it would be much more meaningful if the person that
absolutely
wronged you said to you, you know what, I know I wronged you, and I'm sorry. And in fact, one of the 21 steps, not 21, but 12 steps, is to do exactly that, to admit to yourself that you harmed somebody. And to go to them and say, please forgive me, to try to do something proactive to make that right. Just essential.
Yes, that would be a really great follow-up to do something together, to talk it over together. How can we make this right? But I just wanted to clarify one thing, Andre. I went to Buck, and he didn't put pressure on me. I asked him for his insight. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't want to leave the wrong impression. And even the five-year thing was just a suggestion, like choose your own timeline, maybe 5 years, you know, whatever, just so that it doesn't drift off into the mists all vague. But there's one more thing that my parents could have done that just occurred to me, and I don't think they would have had the insight to do it, but is to say, yeah, it's really good you're giving us so much power to the point where, you know, you can't forgive us. But don't give us so much power. Give the most power to God, because we're just, you know, like we're just filling in some space here on earth.
Yeah.
But God is your real parent. And because that's what's helped me forgive them is I've slowly, slowly, slowly transferred over to God the right to define me, not my parents, because
right.
I didn't like the way my parents defined me. So in... You see,
but here's the question.
Yes.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I want to let you
finish.
Well,
okay. The last thing was that just when I have this little conflict inside myself, it's really clear to me God trumps my parents any day of the week.
Yes.
And, you know.
Yes, that's very important. I agree. And, you know, I think it's so – I know we're getting to the end here of our show, but I just want to one thing that's helping me, and it's something that it's hard for me to remember sometimes, but getting this kind of support really helps. And I really appreciate everything you guys are doing here and saying. I think one thing, you know, you were saying, Lee, you know, if your parents had said to you, don't give us that kind of power, you know, give it over to God. I don't know if my mom would be capable of that, you know, and I think that I have to ask, you know, one of the things I have to remind myself is, what is my mom capable of? You know, what was my dad capable of? You know, and I think if I can see that, it's like it says in the Your Answer book, Jesus says, expect less of some people and you'll be less disappointed. You know, and I have to remind myself of that, because that makes it easier to forgive too when I remind myself that, you know what, your mom doesn't have the spiritual resources. And I don't mean that in a superior sense, like I'm ahead of her or whatever, you know, but she just doesn't. She just does not have that kind of mindset and that kind of worldview. So, you know, does that make it more difficult? I mean, does that make it more difficult to deal with her because she doesn't? Yeah, it does. But it also makes it easier for me to, if I see her as a person who is just not, who's only capable of so much, rather than a person who's deliberately trying to hurt me, you know, that it's kind of like, you know, Jesus saying, forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do, you know.
But see, and that's where I got it from, was Jesus, because the reason he had the strength to say that is because the biggest power in his life was God the Father.
Mm-hmm.
And when God the Father is the biggest power in your life, then it doesn't matter if other people want your forgiveness or not, because you and the Father are seeing that's the right thing to do. I mean, I'm not saying...
I met the most beautiful woman in South Africa, and I've told her story many times, but she said something to me that was so touching. She married a minister who didn't have a father, and she grew up without a father, and she made this comment to me. She said, "Don't you know when we get down on our knees to pray, we know who our Father is."
Mm.
And that was very powerful, because I think if you have that, you can overcome a great deal of inadequacies in parenting, in your, you know, in who parented you or didn't parent you, you know.
And I think, and Lee, were you, did you ever get a chance to have children?
Yeah, I have two boys. And that's,
I'm sorry?
Yes,
you would. I have never had children, but I hope to God that I get to, because, you know, not just I can get my parental experience, but because I really believe, and I can't prove this, but I really believe that much of my healing will come when I get to become a parent myself.
That's true.
You really do, as Paul had already said earlier in the broadcast, you really do experience that unconditional love that you would die for your children, you know, and that gives you a little taste of God's love for us.
And we will talk to everybody next week.
Okay, Andre. Until then, my friend.